Show, and we are continuing our State of the Program series where we examine some of the biggest programs in college football. A very intriguing one today, one that we don't know what direction this program is going, and this year could be very telling, and that is Virginia Tech. So we bring in Andy Bitter, the Athletics Virginia Tech beat writer, to talk Hokies. We'll grab some turkey legs and start chomping, and we're going to talk about the Hokies. But Andy, this has been just a really interesting last 3 or 4 years. Really, you know, Justin Fuente has the great first year where they go to the ACC championship game, and it feels like the program is just sort of going to come back to where it was at the height of the Frank Beamer era. And then things got weird.
Yeah, that could pretty much describe the last decade of this team, pretty much since I came on the beat. I came on the beat at the very end.
It's your fault.
Yeah, I think it is my fault. I came on the beat in 2011, and that was sort of the last vestige of the heyday years for the Hokies in the ACC, and they made the ACC title game, and they've only been to one since then. And it was in that 2016 season. It was sort of an odd marriage of all of Frank Beamer's players and then Justin Fuente taking over and coming in with Gerard Evans, who really transformed that offense and turned that offense into something special. But then Gerard Evans goes pro. A lot of those defensive players that were standing out on the Frank Beamer's teams left, and they just haven't really been able to replace them, and the offense hasn't been able to be up on that level. So it's kind of a program in search of an identity or an identity crisis. And I think they recently sort of admitted that they had to play catch up in this whole thing with this big fundraising deal that they announced to trying to catch the athletic department up in some of the schools in the upper tier of the ACC. But I think it's a program that cruised along for a while when it was having success, and then when sort of the bottom fell out, they weren't prepared for it. And now they're trying to play catch up right now, and Justin Fuente is the guy that's got to turn that around. And I think a lot of people don't know if he's the guy for the job.
Well, that's the strangest thing about this. I remember right around signing day, there was the deal where Whit Babcock, the athletic director, was going to have a press conference, and it said, Whit Babcock will be available to talk about the future of the football program. And it was like the day after signing day, and you're like, wait a second, what does that mean? And then they said, oh, yeah, Justin Fuente will talk about the signing class on Wednesday. I was like, okay, don't send the first email out without sending the second one first, it sounds like you're firing the coach.
It was even worse than that because it was the day before signing, or Whit Babcock was going to talk the day before signing day, which also happened to be the day that Justin Fuente's buyout dropped by $2.5 million. and the only reason it was like that is because of this strange delayed season where it would, you know, the last game happened, and then a couple days later when that would happen. Normally it would be weeks after the season; it would never come into play, but you've got to be wary of that if you're sending out that email and go, we're going to talk about the future of the program the day the coach's buyout drops by a hefty sum. So, a little bit of mixed messages in that whole thing. But, you know, it's never a great spot to be in as a program if your athletic director has to come out and have a press conference to explain why he didn't fire the coach. I thought it was an interesting press conference that Babcock had where he was sort of reading off material and, you know, maybe stepped his foot in his mouth a couple times at the phrasing of a couple things. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're going with Fuente for another year. I think financially probably had to, just based on where they were as a program. But we'll see if he can turn it around, if he can turn it around to a satisfactory level that people go, hey, let's continue him on for a seventh season. I mean, seven seasons, you've given him a chance at that point. It's not like you're cutting him off at the knees before he really had a chance.
It's crazy to think that it's been that long that he's been there, that it's been that long since Frank Beamer was the head coach. I mean, and I think that's the thing that from the outside is the most striking to me, is this program was a model of consistency. When they joined the ACC, they were basically carrying the ACC until Florida State got good again, until Clemson became what it is. But, you know, now you don't know what they are. Like, they had such a readily identifiable identity. That's a little redundant, but
that works.
But no, it was It was so easy to understand. You knew what Virginia Tech was under Beamer. And now you just really don't, because, you know, they're playing a bunch of different quarterbacks, and a lot of that's out of necessity. They'd had injuries. Looks like Braxton Burmeister's the guy right now, especially with Hendon Hooker transferring to Tennessee. You know, their best back was a Kansas transfer, which you'd think Virginia Tech would be able to have homegrown backs that would work, because that was a position that they always seemed to be stocked at. And then, but they're still producing first rounders. I mean, Caleb Farley and Christian Jarosaw, first round draft picks.
Very straight. And that's two first round draft picks for the second time in the last 4 years. You go back to the Edmonds brothers in, I think it was the 2018 draft. Obviously, those guys were recruited under Frank Beamer. But yeah, it's been an odd decade, like I mentioned. I mean, you talk about Khalil Herbert. The last running back they had like that was producing at that level was David Wilson. And you're talking about 2011. Yeah. And this was a program that had Kevin Jones, Lee Suggs, obviously guys before that, but Darren Evans, Ryan Williams, just this assembly line of running backs. And then it just stopped. And this wasn't when – it's not like this coincided when Fuente got here. This was the latter Frank Beamer
years. No, it was going down.
Yeah. So, I mean, it hit a point where something kicked in, and it just wasn't the same. And I think the recruiting wasn't at the same level. I think maybe they got a little complacent with resources. I mean, people always talk about Virginia Tech and, oh, they did more with less. Well, you go back when they were really good around the turn of the century, and they did more with more. I mean, they had brand new facilities. They were considered state of the art at the time. When Frank
they had Beamer, Michael Vick.
Well, yeah, that too. But I mean, the other stuff around that, when Frank Beamer flirted with North Carolina, nearly took that job in 2000. A lot of that was about assistant coach salaries. And when they bumped the salaries at Virginia Tech, that put them actually third in the country at the time. And I think that was behind, oddly at the time, it was behind like NC State and Texas, I think it was. Like NC State after Chuck Amato had gotten there and beefed up the resources there. So that's what it was when they were really successful. And then you go, you know, 10 years later, and somebody like Bud Foster is not even making $1 million. He didn't make $1 million a year until his last year as the coordinator. So we're talking about 20, yeah, I forget the year exactly when his last year, 2019 was his last year.
Yeah, when he was with Fuente.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very bizarre that you're not paying Bud Foster that much. So I think there's a little bit of complacency set in with the program. Like, well, we're doing so great. Why do we need to bring more money and keep up with stuff in a time when college football was exploding with salaries and resources and everything like that? So they realize it now, but they got to catch up.
Yep. I know a program like that. That actually very much describes what the situation Florida was in a few years ago, because they had said, oh, you know, Steve Spurrier and Urban Meyer won with all this, you know, without all this, why do you need it? And it turns out just you need it because everybody has it. And right. Then people start to wonder why you don't. So it's Virginia Tech, maybe even a little behind Florida on that one. Florida, they've got the dedicated football building that they've drawn up and they're going to try to do. And Virginia Tech, they're trying to raise money for all that stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, they recently just had a big sort of building splurge here. They redid their weight rooms and their meeting rooms. They're redoing their players' lounge right now. It's not all centralized in one building, but they've built a lot of stuff. There's a dorm going in that will house like half athletes for freshman athletes there. So it's a lot of stuff that over time other schools have that they didn't, that now they're catching up on with all this stuff. And, you know, we'll see if that pays off down the line recruiting-wise.
So let's talk about them on the field, because it does seem like defensively they should be taking a step forward this year, especially in the secondary. You know, Farley's a first-round pick. He didn't even play last year. He was one of the first guys to opt out.
Yeah, I think, and it's even beyond Farley, because you look at Farley opted out. Devin Hunter, who was expected to step into the safety spot, whether you know the best recruit ratings-wise that Fuente had in his time here, get suspended over a felony charge, a felony strangulation charge that recently was pled down to a misdemeanor. I don't know if that necessarily means he'll come back, but you know, at least he has resolved the felony charge there. And then Jermaine Waller, who was a cornerback that, you know, he wasn't Caleb Farley in 2019, but he was pretty close. I mean, they had two of the best cornerbacks in the ACC that year, and then neither of them are there last year. And not only are neither of them there last year, but the guys behind them are really, really young. I mean, Dorian Strong started five games, I think, as a true freshman. You don't normally get that at Virginia Tech. There's usually a little bit of buildup to that. So I think getting Jermaine Waller back to full health, having Dorian Strong having played a year to pair with Chamari Connor in the secondary, I think just getting a little bit more talent and experience there is going to pay off. And obviously having an actual offseason with your coordinator, you know, Justin Hamilton had to replace Bud Foster and then didn't have an offseason and then had COVID to deal with as well. I mean, he missed the first two games himself because of that whole thing. That's a pretty tough ask of a pretty young coordinator like that. So I think all those things married together, I think, yes, you should see an improvement just on that alone, whether or not they upgrade the talent.
So the thing about Virginia Tech, that there was some weird results over the last
few
years.
To say the least.
And yeah, it just, and then you have these teams, they'll kind of have this odd thing happen. And then like in 2019, the Duke game just sort of stands out. And I remember watching that game and going, what is going on there? What is happening? And then they get better. They got better as that season went on. But then you get to last year, like North Carolina averaging 9-point-something yards a carry against Virginia Tech. And you're thinking, how on earth is this even possible?
Yeah, that game, I think you can at least sort of explain it away in that they didn't have any safeties in that game. All their starters were out because of COVID. On top
that only explains the last 4 yards of the 9.
That's true.
Nine
well, I mean, they, yeah, their defensive front was getting pushed around like crazy. In their defense, Miami's defensive front got pushed around like that.
Yes, 10 yards of carry against Miami.
And that was a pretty good Miami defense, too. So, you know, I think that was an elite running game that they were going up against. But that one was a tough one to see, but I think it's sort of explainable. Maybe less explainable was the loss to Wake Forest not too long after that. They just did not play well offensively in that game. When they turned it over a couple times, probably should not have lost that game. Then you look at something like Liberty. And I realize Liberty was a good team last year, and they have a player in Malik Willis that is going to be a difference maker. But, and I've written this before, the end of that game was coaching malpractice, where they called timeout when the guy's lining up for a 57-yard field goal. They block it, return it for a touchdown, but it was wiped out because they called timeout. And then they don't get the defense set up and allow a quick pass, and he kicks the field goal, and they lose. I mean, that's just, you can't do that as a coaching staff. You can't do that, especially if the previous year you lost a game by 35 points to a Duke team that was terrible. And you can't do that if the year before that you lose to Old Dominion, a pretty bad Old Dominion team that finished 4-8 that year, I believe, and you lose to them on the road, and that sort of set off this whole free fall, the spiral that Virginia Tech has been in. So it seems like they have one of those a year. And if I'm Justin Fuente, you got to avoid that this year. You can't be on a now or never hot seat type season and have another one of those losses. I don't know what game on the schedule would be that. They always seem to prop up out of nowhere. I would suggest to him not losing to Richmond, though. The FCS team on the schedule.
The Spiders. Yeah, that would be a nasty bite.
He's already lost to Old Dominion and Liberty, and I realize those are FBS teams, but maybe don't lose that game to the FCS team. That would have some horrible consequences to it.
They don't have VMI anytime soon, right?
They have them coming up on the schedule in a couple years. It's a one-off deal, I think, but they have not played in a long, long time. And VMI all of a sudden is actually pretty good.
Avoid. Yep. Well, and this is also a year, and this is, you know, part of being in the ACC now, but this is a year when they get Notre Dame. And this is probably not the year you want to have Notre Dame coming in. You'd like to miss them in a do-or-die type year. But they've got West Virginia. You know, Neil Brown has done a very good job, and it's one of those in an alternate universe. If Neil Brown had been available to hire when they were looking, that's probably a good fit. Now, I don't think that would change anything now, but that's one of those, if you lose to West Virginia, there's going to be a lot of what might have been kind of situations, because that's also somebody you might have gone after if you fired Justin Fuente.
Yeah, and there's not a fan base, I think, that irritates the Hokies fan base more than West Virginia. I mean, they haven't played the series. They played a one-off game at FedEx a couple years ago, and that was actually a really entertaining game that Virginia Tech won. I think that was in Fuente's second year that he was here, but they haven't played in Morgantown since 2005. And part of that was just sort of the rivalry had to cool off a bit. It had gotten a bit too heated. I did a story a couple years ago revisiting the rivalry, and some of the older players were talking about how they'd be standing on the sidelines and all the coaches are like, keep your helmets on, because there'd just be this like hail of coins coming down from the crowd on the sidelines, and you could go by and just like scoop up like $3 in coins on the bench. I think Jim Weaver, Jim Weaver, the athletic director here, said that like some fans had complained about getting hit by bags of urine or something like that. So it got to a point where I think both sides need to be like, hey, let's just put this on ice for a decade and a half. But it's back now. So I've been to Morgantown once for a game, covered an Auburn game there where they got crushed in the second half, the beginning of the end of the Tuberville era there. But I haven't been to a game there in a long time, so I'm eager to go back. I don't think a lot of Virginia Tech fans necessarily are about this series, but that's one you don't want to lose, because if you do, man, people will be upset about it.
There are many, many Tudor's Biscuit worlds that they can hit on the drive up. That's what they really need to think about. Forget potential hostilities once they get to Morgantown. Just think about biscuits along the way.
Fill up on biscuits, and that'll pacify you once you're up there.
Well, the game that jumps out on the schedule to me is the first one. I personally love starting with conference games, and the Big Ten's finally getting on board with this. The SEC has done this a little bit over the years, but the ACC was kind of the pioneer of this. They would do Florida State, Miami to start the season sometimes. They've done a bunch of other different, good games to start the season. But Virginia Tech, North Carolina, Friday night of week one. Like, that's a measuring stick right there. Sam Howell, potential first-round draft pick. Obviously, North Carolina loses a lot from that team last year, but I don't get the sense that they're slowing down in terms of talent acquisition.
They aren't, but I think if you want to play them, you want to play them then, don't you? Before they have all the answers to these, four NFL guys before they lost.
Exactly.
I think I look at that and I go, if I'm Virginia Tech, that's the perfect time that I want to play that game. It's at home. You think the restrictions will be lifted on fan attendance in that game. So that's going to be a place that has like a year of pent up frustration of fans coming out to attend. So I have to imagine that place will be jumping at the time. And you look at Justin Fuente's track record in season openers, and he's pretty good in them. He's 4-1 in those games. I mentioned the West Virginia game they won. They go down to Florida State and won that Florida State game, and the defense just dominated that game. And as it turns out, Florida State was terrible. So we look at that in hindsight, not as impressive. But at the time, you go, wow, they went down there and looked really, really prepared for this game. Last year, they had NC State in the opener after they had all the COVID issues, and they went out and they just crushed them. I mean, it was just an absolute, blitzed them on the ground completely. The one loss they had was at Boston College, and that was a game where just turnovers killed them in that game, and it was a lot of interceptions that were problematic there. So from a preparation standpoint, I think Fuente does a pretty good job of getting this team up for a big opener like that. And then you get the big stage, the big crowd. You have UNC maybe trying to figure out some things on its offense with all the replacement parts. I feel like that's a good recipe for Virginia Tech.
Well, and if they can win that game, it puts them in a completely different mind space for the whole season. And they don't play another ACC game until October 16th. So that's one. If you win that game, you can then work any kinks you have out during the rest of the non-conference schedule, and then hit the ground rolling when you play in conference. But having that, if they could win it, if they could have that game in hand, because that's the team that's supposed to win the Coastal, I think it would change. It would probably change the mindset of everybody involved. And then conversely, if they lose and lose badly, it may poison the well for the rest of the way.
Exactly. It's a major game, to say the least. You can win it. You're in the sort of the driver's seat, or the pole position, I guess you should say, in the Coastal. with that tiebreaker of a team that's going to be up there, and you lose, and it's just going to be more of the same of what it's been the last couple of years. Fire Fuente, and then you know, on top of that, you've got games at West Virginia and versus Notre Dame up in the first 5 weeks. You know, this could be over before it starts if it gets off the rails there pretty quickly. So, yeah, if he wins, I think that buys him a little bit of goodwill and maybe a little bit of leeway with the fans if things maybe aren't perfect in that first month. But if you lose, you know, what are you looking forward to? You're already behind the eight ball in the division, and you have a tough non-conference coming up. And, you know, that's one of their hated rivals in UNC. I think it's even up there with UVA in terms of, you know, how much people hate within the conference. So that'd be a tough one to come back from, I think, just emotionally if they lose that game to UNC.
Well, and I feel like the rest of the ACC schedule is manageable because their cross-divisional games are Syracuse and Boston College. So. Right. And Halfley did a good job, and Yurkovic is a very good quarterback, but you'd much rather see Boston College than you would Clemson, you know? So, and that's the issue. And, you know, we don't know what Florida State's going to be, but that's a manageable schedule for Virginia Tech. So I think you're right. I think if they can win or even play well and lose against North Carolina, then it doesn't poison the well the rest of the way. Then they're kind of on even footing, and they could conceivably still win the Coastal. I mean, it really depends on how North Carolina would do after that, because this is entirely manageable. But the one thing I did want to ask you, Andy, is how much does what Bronco Mendenhall has done at Virginia change things for Virginia Tech?
I think it changes things because there's actually a legitimate rival in the state now. I mean, UVA used to be such a pushover, and it was a sort of a running joke within the Hokies fan base. Like, you know, there's not a rivalry, really. I mean, when you win 15 straight against one team, you know, what is the rivalry there? It's you know, Charlie Brown trying to kick the football, and Lucy pulls it away every single year. Yeah. I mean, the number of times...
That would be the 2018 game, by right. the way. That's exactly what that
game
was.
That game was absurd. But the number of times we writers, like, you know, you talk yourself into Virginia to win in a certain year, like, I don't know, I think this is the year, and then it goes out, and it's the same result in sort of the same manner over and over. And Bronco has changed that. He's made that a program that I don't think you're going to go out and pick them to win the division or anything like that. But that's going to be a tough out this year. And I actually just talked to Bronco the other day for my State of the Program I'm doing on UVA. And, you know, they really like Brennan Armstrong. And they always have a good defense that they put on the field. I know they've struggled against pass defense lately, but that's sort of, you know, Bronco's baby there is that defense. And they're just problematic for teams. They're maybe not going to impress you with their star rankings or anything like that, but they're a tough out, and teams found that out last year. Like North Carolina, you know, was flying pretty high, and then they go into Charlottesville, and UVA beats them 44-41. You know, that wouldn't have been the case, I think, when it was Mike London or the latter Al Groh years where you see UVA on the schedule, and you go, okay, this is a game you don't really need to be your sharpest in.
Well, and it brings up a bigger picture question, because you've got Bronco making UVA better and also probably recruiting better at UVA than his predecessors did. You've got Mike Loxley at Maryland, obviously different conference now for Maryland, but Mike Loxley is a great recruiter of the DMV region. What does that leave for Virginia? And I guess North Carolina is another one, because, you know, when Matt Brown has it going, they'll go up into that area as well and recruit guys, and obviously the best of the players from that area have been willing to leave. You know, they've been willing to go to Alabama. Eddie Goldman going to Florida State a few years ago. They've been willing to go elsewhere. How does Justin Fuente keep some of those guys near home?
Well, he hasn't. I think that's been one of the problems. And I'll throw another name out there for you that could start stealing a guy or two here every year: Shane Beamer. It's South Carolina.
Oh, yeah, it's South Carolina. Yep.
Obviously, Virginia ties, and he's got Torian Gray, who's got instant credibility in the state, running the secondary there. So, yeah, I think it makes it difficult for Fuente to go in state and keep guys here, and that's been a problem. I mean, I know they signed, was it 7 guys last year from in state? I think the top-ranked guy in state was still 16th. The year before that, they signed one guy from Virginia, and I think he was ranked 23rd. So they need to do better within the state. They've made some coaching changes, hired some guys with that in mind. Guys like Ryan Smith, J.C. Price coming on from Marshall has some pretty good in-state ties. I think what you notice with that sometimes, though, it doesn't happen immediately. I mean, you have to work these relationships and build them up over time. So I don't. It's like moving a barge. I don't know how quickly you can get this whole thing turned around. I don't know if you can get it turned around quickly enough to save your job here at Virginia Tech. But yeah, I think some of these in-state recruits looked at Virginia Tech going to Texas, throwing a lot of attention in Texas's direction and other states that they're wondering, hey, you look at us here in the state. I think that maybe rubs some people the wrong way here. And those are relationships that Fuente will need to mend here. And, you know, until he does, they're going to continue to be second, third fiddle for a lot of these in-state prospects.
Well, and if you look at the top five ranked recruits in the class of 2021 from the state of Virginia, Clemson, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Virginia, Tennessee. You know, I mean, only one staying in state, and that's some fierce comment. When you have to Clemson, Ohio State, and Oklahoma, it's hard to say no to those programs when they come in.
It is, and I mean that's been an issue for a long time. I think you go back to that Percy Harvin class in 2006. I can't remember the exact date of that class.
It was 2006. Yep,
that was sort of the. You know, warning flare there for Virginia Tech, where Virginia Tech had done very well with those top guys in state for a good number of years after that national championship game appearance. And then 2007, they get Tyrod Taylor, and a couple years after that, David Wilson and Logan Thomas, a couple top guys in the state. But after that, it has really been a struggle. So this has been a problem that's been brewing for a while. I think it's been magnified a bit under Fuente, but they just need to do better on the home front, because you're going to get a better evaluation on those guys. And if things are tough, maybe they stick around a little bit longer. That might be contributing to some of the transfer portal problems that Virginia Tech has. But you need to win some hearts and minds on the home front, I think, to be successful at a place like Virginia Tech.
So, Andy, I'm not going to ask you what you think is going to happen, because as we've covered, they're very unpredictable these days, the Hokies. But what does Justin Fuente have to do to solidify his status?
I think he's got to be right there in the mix in the Coastal Division. I don't know if he necessarily has to win it. And notably, Whit Babcock didn't put any sort of win-loss requirement on him coming back. He's not like, you got to go 8-4.
He
wasn't Nebraska. He wasn't Nebraska going out there going, hey, this looks like 9 or 10 wins. Like, what are you doing, Nebraska? Stop setting yourself up for failure like that. So I have to give him credit on that front for not going out and go, well, he needs to go 8-4. I'm going to fire him. Because, you know, who's the 8-4 against? Do you go 8-4 but lose to UNC, Notre Dame, West Virginia, and Virginia? That's probably not a successful year in a lot of people's eyes here for the Hokies. But say you have a weird loss, but you still win the Coastal Division and you go 8-4. I think that's good enough to stick around going ahead. So I think he's got to be competitive in the Coastal Division. I think he's got to beat Virginia. I mean, just continue to beat Virginia. If you don't keep doing that becomes problematic. I think that was a big issue after that 2019 season, certainly with people sort of jumping off the Fuente bandwagon there. And I just think they've got to avoid these head-scratching losses, because it's just demoralizing, I think, for the fans to be like, well, you've given Old Dominion a trash-talking point for life because of that one result in 2018. Just like, you know, James Madison has a trash-talking point for life because of that 2010 game. And now Liberty has a trash-talking point for life because of last year's game. I mean, the entire state has something that they can just throw in Virginia Tech's face if there's an argument about who's the better team. It's like, well, remember that game that we beat you that we shouldn't have?
But the thing is, beating them is kind of the lifetime achievement now. Virginia Tech's got to keep it that way, right? Virginia Tech has to keep winning for that to still matter.
Right. But I just think that you can't have a loss like that. You can't have one like ODU in 2018. Can't have one like Duke in 2019, where it's just every year there seems to be at least one week where they just don't show up in a game that they absolutely should win. And it's just like, well, what coaching is going on here if you can't get these guys up to play in a game like that? It's not even like, you know, that Duke game wasn't even close. Like, that's the thing about it that was just so strange. It's like, they just were not even competitive. They were lifeless. That was a game where they were honoring the 1999 team, the national championship team. So like Mike Vick was there and Frank Beamer came out at halftime. They had a little montage and they're getting the brakes beat off by a Duke team that it turns out was not very good.
It wasn't good. Yeah.
So it's I think those are the kind of losses that, you know, cumulatively over the years, it's like, well, what's coming next? When is this going to, you know, fall off the table here and we're going to get blindsided by a game again?
So none of those, Justin Fuente, and we're having a different conversation here next year. A few of those, and Andy and I are talking about a different coach here next year. So it is going to be an adventure of a season, as usual, in Blacksburg. Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It'll be an interesting one to watch, for sure.